Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. Today we're going to have a different type of conversation. My guest has both South African and English roots. He's been involved in both the investment and corporate worlds, while simultaneously being an active parliamentarian, vice chairman of the All Africa Parliamentary Group, and lord-in-waiting to the Queen. Born in South Africa, a member of the ANC, friend of Nelson Mandela, he trained as a lawyer, worked as an oil analyst, and was in the city for 17 years before becoming a CEO of a data hosting company, and currently is chairman of three very different corporations. So the plan today is to move from South Africa to the UK, from cybercrime and Parliament's activities here, to uranium's investment opportunity, investing in Africa, and his perspectives on Nelson Mandela, given today's racial turbulence. Anthony St. John, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you, Simon. It's always a delight to be with you and very honoured to be part of this podcast.
Fantastic. Well, let's start in South Africa. Tell me a little bit about your education.
Well, very simply, I was born in London, came over to South Africa when I was 3 months old. So I was educated in Cape Town, went to university in Cape Town. Sadly, my father died when I was just 20. So I finished my education, did my university degree, and then I went on, did my articles, became a solicitor. But I took my seat in the House of Lords in 1978. That was a year before Margaret Thatcher came to power. Obviously, that changed my life enormously because I ended up starting a life which was really a mix of playing politics as well as business, and also took me eventually back to the UK.
And is it true you were almost penniless and had a camper van that you parked in the House of Lords car park, and on your first arrival there, you were asked to move on and told that that was where you were going to sleep?
Well, that is true. I did my master's at LSE. And when I'd finished my degree, I had 4 months before I moved over to spend almost a year living in China. And in that 4 months, I had given up my student digs. I bought a camper van, spent some time touring around the UK. But to save money, I did live in the House of Lords car park for up to a month and a half, possibly the best address in London.
But Anthony, we're going to talk a little bit sometimes about obstacles that they've overcome. Many listeners will have watched the King's Speech, but I'd like you to just tell us a little bit about the really difficult disability you had, which was a very pronounced stammer.
Well, this has been a hereditary problem. My father had a very bad stutter. I became the 21st Lord St. John of Bledsoe in 1978, and my biggest problem was that I couldn't speak. When you take your seat in the House of Lords, you have to introduce yourself by saying, I, Anthony Tudor, Lord St. John of Bledsoe, do solemnly swear to be true and faithful to the Queen, her successors and heirs. The problem I had is I couldn't say the words F, M, S, R, B, and W. So what has just taken me 15 seconds took me almost 2 minutes, and I made a complete tot of myself.
To the outside world, you are, of course, articulate and polished and successful, but how did you overcome it?
Well, having a stutter is a major impediment. And at the time, I just thought it was something I'd have to live with. I had no idea that I could get out of it. And unfortunately, at school, I got mocked for having a stutter. And this caused me major angst to the degree that I, you know, obviously knew I would be trained as a solicitor, but I didn't think I'd ever be able to do proper court proceedings. The day that I took my seat, I got a little note across the floor of the house from a colleague. It ended up being Alec Douglas Hume, who was the Prime Minister in 1962. He knew my father well. I had tea with him that afternoon, and he recommended that I go to speech therapy. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as speech therapy. And that's why when you see the King's Speech, that was me. I had an acute, my stutter was so bad that I literally couldn't complete a sentence. Therefore, any idea of getting involved in public speaking and active in the House of Lords was complete anathema to me. But a year and a half after having speech therapy, miraculously, it disappeared. And so now, in fact, I don't mind when I have a stutter.
Well, that's a terrific story. So your first job is as a lawyer, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And how did that come about and where did you start?
When I left school, I didn't know what to do. And I had these aptitude tests and IQ tests. And they said I should do two things. One, I should either go into the diplomatic corps or become a lawyer. When I left school, my only two interests were chasing girls and surfing. And when I came home and told my parents that they'd recommend that I be a lawyer or a diplomat, my mother, for one, laughed at me. She said I wasn't serious enough to become a lawyer. And that's part of the reason why I thought, well, that's a challenge, I'll do it. So I did the law, but at the time it was a challenge because that was the days, the bad old days of apartheid, whereas if you were a black person, you were guilty unless proved innocent. And if you were white, you were innocent unless proved guilty. And that caused me a major problem to serve in a legal system which I believed was totally broken.
And so you leave with your law qualification from the LSE and you head to Shell to be internal counsel?
No, in fact, what happened is I did my law degree at LSE and I also did a course in Chinese law at SOAS. And I spent a year living in Hong Kong and almost 8 months living in China. I was one of the first pupils to graduate with a master's in Chinese law. You might say, what was it based on? It was based on Scandinavian code. And the days I was in China was in 82, 83, when everyone's running around in Mao suits. The only cars belong to government. It's extraordinary how China has come on since those days. But when I came back to South Africa, I was pretty uncertain if I want to make my future in South Africa or possibly make the move to the UK. And I was advised to join an international company. And that's what I did. I went and joined Shell. I became legal counsel and very involved in the internal audit division. So I spent almost 5 years at Shell. And then I moved from Shell to become an oil analyst for a company called Fielding, Newson & Smith, which then became NatWest Securities. From there, I joined Smith Newcorp, which then became Merrill Lynch. So I spent almost 17 years in the city.
We're going to come back to energy later, given your role with Yellowcake. But I think I'm right in saying that after your stint there in the city, you moved to data hosting. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because those were the early days of this huge data revolution.
Well, I'm a great believer in serendipity. And at the time, I was pretty fed up with the city. I was thinking of spending more time in the House of Lords. Clearly, the House of Lords needed to have hereditary peers reformed. We had almost 920 hereditary peers, and I knew it was inevitable that Tony Blair, when he became Prime Minister, would reform, if not abolish, hereditary peers. So I decided to spend more time in my parliamentary duties, which I enjoyed. But I also then decided it was inevitable that the digital world would take over from the conventional world. And I was lucky enough to meet a group in New York that were building data centers in London. And we ended up having the second largest data center business in the UK, as well as in Holland.
And how did that shape the future direction?
When you are hosting lots of technology companies, you really get to know the wood from the chaff. And these are in the early days of Amazon, and many of the names that are now common names were unknown in those days. But we were really one of the few companies which were looking not just to provide co-location, but also to provide managed services, which is things like DDoS mitigation tools. In those days, clearly cybersecurity was becoming a massive issue, much more important now than in those days. But we built an integrated technology business, not just providing the pipes for outsourced web hosting, but also the solutions to ameliorate the risks of many technology companies on the web.
So let's just pause on this cybersecurity issue because it's on everybody's lips. You've been very involved. So tell us a little bit about what you do in that area and about your perceptions of how this unfolds, particularly with the fact that during the coronavirus lockdown, more people have been working from home, their computer systems have been less secure, and on top of that, we've had the Huawei and the TikTok issues dominating much of the press.
Yeah, this is a hot subject, and obviously the threat of cybersecurity has been exacerbated by the pandemic lockdown. Obviously, working from home is less secure than working from the office. So we've had what are called spear phishing attacks. Spear phishing attacks are by cyber criminals, which make out that chief executives are receiving emails from their finance directors asking to authorize payments. And normally on those items of expenditure, they go through on the nod. But because of the sophistication of cyber criminals, this has been happening on a regular basis. So there's been a massive uptick in cyber crime since the beginning of lockdown. And these are issues now which are being addressed by companies such as Immersive Labs and DarkTrace and SensorNet, which are protecting machines remotely. But this is going to be an ongoing problem because I think lockdown has had many good sides to it, many bad sides to it. Obviously, we are conducting a lot more of our conversations by Zoom, but it is inevitable that you're going to find many more employees working from home. And this obviously raises the issue of cyber security, because clearly your computer and your systems from home are not nearly as secure as those from the office, which have obviously much more secure firewalls.
And do you think that we in Great Britain have been overly tolerant or even naive about some of the suppliers, such as Huawei, and their ultimate ownership and intentions?
Well, of course, this is a hot subject, and I could be very cynical and say that as a result of the UK-US trade talks going on at the moment, clearly the Americans are very concerned about the cyber threat and the trade war with China. But clearly the 5G rollout was not going to be entirely the Huawei contract. It was only going to be the back part of the contract. But the pressure has been such from many reputable names, both in Parliament as well as from MI5, MI6, and a number of other notable names who've warned against this. So it doesn't surprise me that the British government have decided now to stop the contract with Huawei. And it doesn't just extend to China. It's obviously with Russia as well. We have a race to who will be the first to come up with a vaccine. And of course, the Russians have been noticing the advances that we've been making in our laboratories in Cambridge and elsewhere in the UK in finding a vaccine. And there's been concerns that critical data could possibly be at risk. So a broad answer to a very concise question, but I do believe that cybersecurity right now is a hot, hot subject, and we cannot have enough controls being put in place.
This is something which is the remit, both the public and the private sector. And we are seeing increasingly a collaborative approach. I've been on the House of Lords Communications Select Committee and also the Parliamentary Information Technology Committee. And these are organizations which work together very closely with the private sector, not just the large organizations, the IBMs and the Microsofts and the Oracles and the Hewlett-Packards, but small organizations to come up with a solution which hopefully can provide more protection for consumers going forward.
So whilst all this is going on and you are branching into multiple careers, you are carrying out these parliamentary activities, and particularly your focus has been on Africa. Maybe I know that on your travels you got to know Nelson Mandela well, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about Africa and African investing, because for many people allocating capital, Africa has the population dynamics, it has much hope and expectation. Tell us a little bit how you think about Africa and African investing.
Well, I should unwrap that in two ways. Firstly, obviously, having lived in Africa for over 28 years and having been Lord-in-Waiting to Her Majesty since 1998, where I've been meeting and greeting African heads of state, I've been very involved in Africa on the political front and also the humanitarian front. But in terms of investment, of course, you have 54 countries, of which, of course, the largest in population terms are Nigeria and Egypt and Ethiopia, and increasingly, obviously, South Africa. But investing in Africa is a highly complex issue. Complex because of foreign exchange regulations, complex because there's been a massive problem in many countries in corruption and lack of transparency and lack of proper governance, and also immature stock markets. Of course, South Africa has a very sophisticated stock market, but if you're looking to deal in other parts of Africa, unless you look at possibly Egypt and North Africa, many of the stock markets are pretty illiquid. So a lot of investment has gone in private equity, and that's why a lot of players have gone into the bond markets rather than the equity markets. And whilst there have been some big winners, there have been more losers than winners. So we're hoping that a lot of the issues are going to be de-risked. We've had the UK-Africa Heads of Government Summit in London, and the purpose of that was to look at how to encourage and facilitate trade. This is not just pools of capital going into Africa, but also ways in which there could be more collaboration between the UK and Africa, and also exploiting opportunities in the digital economy. Of course, fintech is transforming the lives of many people in Africa. And I think it's one of the biggest opportunities. You have over 1 billion people, of which I don't know what the exact number is, but I would imagine that something in the region of 70% are unbanked. So you're looking at opportunities of embracing digital technologies. Africa has been an opportunity for many investors in the commodity to looking at oil and gas and mining. The Chinese are still in the march, unfortunately, in Africa, and the Europeans and others have been slow to embrace the opportunity in mining. But when you look at the main sectors of investment, internationals have been more involved in oil and gas and mining than they have been in other sectors such as food and consumables, which I think are the more interesting areas to be involved in now.
You talked about investors being inclined in part to invest towards debt rather than equity. But if the GDP trajectory of Africa is as positive as many think it could be, it should be participation in GDP growth through companies. Now, I know you're chairman of IDH. Tell us a little bit about how you've approached the market, which I think is blood tests.
So IDH stands for Integrated Diagnostic Holdings. We were started in Egypt. We have up to 16 million blood tests, which we've performed over the years. But we predominantly focus on North Africa. We've just expanded into Nigeria, and we're looking to get into Ghana, Ethiopia, South Africa, and other parts of Africa. And also we're in the UAE. But the hematology market is a massive opportunity. Obviously, healthcare is one area that everyone's prepared to spend money on their health. And governments are increasingly looking to provide more incentives to give more preventative medicine rather than reactive medicine. And obviously, blood tests are key to that. And it's very much a cash business. It's not requiring huge amounts of technology. We obviously have not just done blood tests. We're looking to go up the value chain. We're doing radiology, we're doing MRIs, we're doing other scans. But it's the opportunity in healthcare market is enormous in Africa.
Switching companies, your chairman is Strand Hansen. On a week-to-week basis, tell us a little bit about what that involves.
Well, Strand Hansen is based in the West End. We have offices in Ghana, in South Africa, in Nigeria. Our focus is on mining oil and gas. We're an independent, I stress independent, because we, whilst we have our own research and our own sales team, we are not essentially capital raising. We're a nomad. We're the largest nominated advisor for the AIM market for those companies that have access to opportunities in Africa. So we have 46 of our clients are listed on the London Stock Exchange, and we are their nominated advisors. It's one of those organizations that I, having been spent many years in large institutions like Merrill Lynch and NatWest Bank, it's more at the cutting edge of entrepreneurship. And whilst we've been focusing on oil and gas and on mining, our focus to largely now is on fintech and looking to embrace digital opportunities across Africa.
So maybe we can now return to the energy theme that we discussed earlier. You were an oil analyst, you're involved in businesses that are in the extractive industries, the oncoming tsunami of ESG rethinking of investments is, of course, leading to this debate. At the same time, you're chairman of Yellowcake, a uranium producer. How do you think about the future of energy and the place of the oil companies in the, you know, in the new world?
Well, clearly there's been a major shift to renewable energy, and clearly there's been a major shift away from traditional mining such as coal. I am of the belief that oil will be a commodity which will be in demand for many, many years to come. Yes, it's good that we're having more electric cars, but the future of motor cars is not just going to be about lithium and cobalt. I think it's a big opportunity for hydrogen cells. The world is thankfully now waking up to the climate threat. Climate threat is getting much more, certainly from the younger generation, the youth are much more aware of the risks in their generation of climate change. So majors are looking to diversify their portfolios away from their traditional areas of interest, obviously the Shells and the BPs. BP is becoming much more of a green company than it has in the past, and Shell is also beginning to move that way. But I think nuclear has also got a big opportunity, and that's why I took up the opportunity of getting involved as a non-executive chairman of Yellowcake. Yellowcake is not a mining company. What we do is we hold uranium, and it's very much for the longer term.
I note that the price of Yellowcake uranium has fallen from a peak of $140 a pound to $32, and it's already started to rally. And I wondered how you're thinking about the backdrop for uranium.
It's sad that this year the climate change conference had to be postponed because of the global lockdown. But with the increasing move to renewables, the likes of Yellowcake, which of course is a holding company in uranium, have seen a significant increase in demand for our product. Of course, the pandemic has had a significant impact on economies and resulted in a slowdown in manufacturing and commercial activities. Our view is that the supply-demand risk balance is in line with our thesis that we'll see uranium in the long term being significantly higher than what it is at the moment. The uranium price last year was impacted by the Section 232 inquiry by the US, but that uncertainty has now been lifted. So certainly I see a solid increase in uranium prices. But again, at the moment, for many of the producers, they need $50 to make the production viable. You know, obviously, the major suppliers in the world today are Kazakhstan and Namibia, and to a certain degree, Australia. They make up about two-thirds of the world production. But with the price currently at 33, obviously it's got to rise a lot more to make it more viable for these new mining operations to recommence.
And I think I noted from the Yellowcake website that there are 441 reactors globally, 109 planned and 54 under construction. So it's fair to say, given the long-term nature of these projects, that these are unlikely to change dramatically.
Oh, absolutely. There have been construction delays in nuclear power plants, not just in the US and in the UK, but also in France with EDF, in Japan, in Romania. We've seen a rapid slowdown in nuclear power plant construction, but this is not to say that they've been shelved. There's no doubt that they will be back on track where life hopefully resumes to some level of normality. What I would say about the nuclear industry is that obviously the capex is a lot up front, but the running costs of nuclear plants, once they're being constructed, is comparatively low. So whilst we've seen an uptick in the price, we've seen almost a 30% uptick, there's a lot more to go.
So I have to ask you this because many of us watched with amazement and delight as Nelson Mandela took his path after leaving prison. You were fortunate enough to spend a little time with him. Could you just share your thoughts on what made him so special?
I said about serendipity because obviously I didn't anticipate that my father was going to die when I was 20. It was only really after my father's death that I found that my father was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement, and I joined the ANC at a very early age. And obviously when Madiba was released, I met him before when he was actually still in prison, and I got to meet him on numerous occasions thereafter, and he became a very dear friend. He was a man of huge humility. He was one of those extraordinary individuals that when you're with Madiba, he'd make you feel as though you were the only person that he wanted to speak to. And he had the most amazing memory and a wicked sense of humor. His story is a tragic one for after spending all those almost 28 years in incarceration in Robben Island and in Pulsmore Prison. And what is extraordinary about the man is when he came out, many people would have thought that he would have been full of vengeance and anger and retribution. That wasn't Madiba. Madiba believed in the Rainbow Nation. He was passionate about youth. I asked him once what was the saddest time of his life, and he said when he lost his son. He lost his son in a motorcycle accident. And that for him was one of the things that he found very difficult to cope with. And that's why also he had this passion, the Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund. So I worked closely with Madiba. We met each other when he came to the UK. I went to see him in East London, and I spent as much time with him before he became president as I did after he became the president. And it's a shame that Oliver Tambo, who obviously he was extremely close to, died a few years earlier. Oliver was very close to Madiba. In fact, I had lunch with Oliver Tambo in the House of Lords when his family were living in the UK. And Oliver's daughter, Tembi, is now the South African High Commissioner in London.
So I'd like to ask you a slightly different question. The word iconoclast has been used a lot recently. I had to look it up. It's described as a person who attacks or pulls down images or institutions from the past. And the furore around Cecil Rhodes and his statue at Oriel College, Oxford, and many others, is raising all sorts of questions about people wanting to rewrite the past. And I wonder, how do you think Nelson Mandela would have responded to this issue?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Of course, the world has changed radically since the death of Madiba, but he would have embraced Black Lives Matter's sentiment. He would have been certainly supportive of the movement, but he would have been very uneasy about putting down the statues. This is a very sensitive issue. If you look at the iconic characters in Black Lives Matter, it's not just Nelson Mandela, but of course, Martin Luther King and partly Barack Obama. The vision and the sentiment of Madiba was very much one of being inclusive rather than exclusive. So I would imagine if he was alive today that he would have recommended that these controversial statues be put in museums. But he wanted to promote people getting together and for long-term solutions, hence the name the Rainbow Nation. So I do not believe, and this actually was reinforced by, I don't know whether you heard the interview just a few weeks ago by Gracia Michel, who was Madiba's wife. And she said that she was supportive of the movement, but she was not in favor of pulling down statues. She thought that was highly provocative. Mandela's vision was certainly to embrace radical transformation of attitudes, but he wanted to do so to make a positive difference. I think what has happened in the US, and this has partly been spurred by Donald Trump, is that the United States is no longer the United States of America. I think it's the disunited states. I've never in my 63 years known a time when the United States has been so divided, divided on racial grounds, divided on wealth grounds, divided on so many issues. And I really do think now, with COVID-19, this should be a time to come together to solve global problems. So I deviate from your question, but I go back to the point that I think if Mandela was alive today, having this tragic situation with the death of George Floyd, I think he would have tried to intervene to promote positive change of attitudes, positive changes of behavior, but certainly not tried to incinerate and cause the situation to become worse than it is already.
Let's stay with youth, because we have on the Money Maze podcast quite a lot of young listeners, some of whom are leaving or thinking about what they're going to do as they leave university. You yourself have children of a similar age. Tell us a little about what's the advice that you would give to young people thinking about their careers?
Well, this is a big issue. In many parts of the world, and I here refer to South Africa, you're finding a lot of youngsters leaving universities and not being able to find a job. And it's a universal challenge. My children are now 24, 23, 22, and 20. And they've all struggled to find their niches. But if I were to give five bits of advice as to what I would suggest, and this is the advice I gave to my children, I said, whatever you do in your life, you must be passionate. You mustn't feel duty-bound to go into any profession. Be passionate about what you choose. My son, for example, has gone into social impact management consultancy. He could quite easily have gone into the city, but he decided that's what he's passionate about. Number two, I think it's important for young people to deal with people who have integrity. A lot of time, people are so passionate about making money that they don't, in fact, put filters on. And that, I think, is a very important. I think also, this is maybe somewhat outside of your question, I think everyone needs to learn from mistakes. We all make mistakes in our lives. We make mistakes when we're young, when we're old, we're all ages. And I think you learning from mistakes, you can become a better person, and you can have a clearer idea about what you want to do going forward. Also, I think it's important to take second opinion when you leave school, you go and have a job. I think a lot of people who go out in the job market feel that they should do so very much from the influence of their parents, whereas I think that the options nowadays are immense. You don't necessarily have to go into the conventional businesses of accountancy and law. The world of digital is wide open. And I think that the advice that I give to my children is don't be in too much of a rush. In your 20s, you go for experience. In your 30s, you go for focus. And in your 40s, if you're lucky enough, you make money.
Well, Anthony, what an extraordinary journey you've had. I'm really delighted you have been able to come on the Money Maze. I think for our listeners, those pieces of advice, passion, integrity, patience is something that we can all take on board and remember. And I just want to thank you again very much indeed for being with us today.
Simon, great pleasure. Anytime. Cheerio.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time.